You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I mean, one of the amazing things is that there are now almost 50 million people in the United States who are using food stamps or food aid. 50 million people in the richest country in the world, and half of all U.S. children, all children in America, half of them will require food aid at some point during their childhood. And for African American children, it's 90%. And this in the midst of the most obscene wealth that exists alongside that poverty.
That's the voice of Dr. David McNally. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. McNally about his new book, Global Slump, The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. We speak about what the proposed austerity measures mean for people around the world and how people are fighting back, forming a new global resistance against these measures. So stay tuned.
A lot of the suffering that we see is suffering that is man-made, that is caused by particular policies, economic policies, that construct a world in terms that are deterministic, in terms that are dehumane, and that reject the reciprocity, I think, that is inherent in every human being. My next guest is Dr. David McNally. He teaches political science at York University, Toronto. You can reach him by going to his blog, davidmcnally.org. His recent book on the world economy is Global Slump, The Economic and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Sylvia.
The notion that in order to save the patient of economics today, we need to draw more blood, which is what I consider this austerity project. In your book, you use other terms, so I call it insanity. So I wonder if you could just take us to the logic that people are trying to impose, this level of impunity and oppression that is reflected through austerity measures of imposing taxes on the poor to enrich those who are already wealthy.
Yes, I think you summed it up beautifully there, Sylvia, because really what we're talking about is, as you say, the logic of an economic system whose motivating principle, whose driving force is profit, not satisfying human needs, but producing profit for privately owned corporations and banks. And so the terrible tragedy of this economic system is that when it goes into difficulties, the way it gets out is doing everything possible to restore and boost corporate profitability, feeding the engine, the machinery of profits. And so right now, we've come through the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression, with the huge collapse of banks that began in 2008 on Wall Street, when five investment banks collapsed, and then the cascading of bank collapses, Germany, England, Ireland, Spain, and so on, that happened throughout the global north. And our rulers did everything in their powers to pump public wealth, wealth taken from the citizens, into the banking system. Altogether, they put something in the neighborhood of $26 or $27 trillion into the world's banks and into the so-called stimulus programs to revive the economy. Now, to give you a sense of what $26 or $27 trillion looks like, that's all the wealth that the American economy produces in 2 years. If you took every penny of wealth that the American economy produces over 2 years, you would have pumped that into the banks. But then the problem is, governments have to pay for that because essentially they borrowed to do that. They borrowed on international markets to raise the money to do that, and then they have to pay it back. And one of the key ways they do that is they reduce their spending on social programs. They massively cut spending on health care, education, welfare, maternal rights, child programs, child health programs, and so on. They cut all those programs so that they can pay back the foreign investors, the global financiers, that they borrowed the money from in the first place. So what we've got now, and it is, as you said earlier, it is a human tragedy. It is imposing enormous human suffering, and if you'd like, I can take you through some of the facts and figures on that shortly. It's imposing that kind of suffering and hardship on poor working-class people in country after country after country to pay for bailing out private banks. In other words, the public is paying for the failure of private profit-making institutions, and there's a terrible, really sad irony in that.
Now, when we think about this kind of racketeering exercise, you know, where we steal from the poor to give to the rich, we kind of hear from our politicians that that's the way the world works. And we hear from our institutions, whether it's education or others, that it is important to obey authority. And in our case, authority has always meant those with power and money have the most authority to decide how the world should operate. So can you just paint a picture? What is really at stake? What are we losing? What are we fighting against?
Well, we're losing human well-being, a sense of social solidarity and community. We're losing sight of larger public purposes beyond individual profit-making. And I'll give you some concrete kinds of images to give a sense of that. The state of California has eliminated public health insurance for 900,000 poor children. The state of Michigan has ordered Detroit, the city of Detroit, to close half its schools. That means that a city with predominantly African American children will now have classes with 65 kids in them. Latvia has fired one-third of all of its teachers. One out of every three teachers is just gone. Ireland, just a few weeks ago, slashed 20% from the wages of its nurses. In Greece, pensions have been cut between one-third and one-half, which means hundreds of thousands, maybe millions more, elderly living below the poverty line. So that's the first thing we have to see, is that this is going to impose enormous hardship on people. Real human suffering, disease, poverty, hunger. I mean, one of the amazing things is that there are now almost 50 million people in the United States who are using food stamps or food aid. 50 million people in the richest country in the world, and half of all U.S. children, all children in America, half of them will require food aid at some point during their childhood. And for African American children, it's 90%. And this in the midst of the most obscene wealth that exists alongside that poverty. So that's really the first side of what we're looking at. But the second aspect of it is in referring, for instance, to privatization, because we've now got a mayor here in Toronto, where I'm working and living, who is manically trying to privatize social services. The other thing it does is it destroys the sense that as a community, we pool our funds in order to make sure that basic services, the picking up of garbage, the teaching of our children, the caring for the sick and the elderly in hospitals, that all of that is done on a not-for-profit basis, that people get the services they need, not the services they can pay for, that your health care is too important to be left to private markets. For instance, that sense of community and social solidarity gets destroyed. And so as communities, we become weaker. We become more isolated, more fragmented, more locked into our own little silos and losing that sense of social responsibility and, as I said, social solidarity. So it's really affecting us at a lot of levels. And by the way, when the last happens, one of the things we also notice is that mental health problems escalate, that people who feel lonely, detached, as if nobody in the world cares for them, suffer mentally and emotionally, spiritually. And so we've got to recognize that it's not just economics in a numbers sense, the way the politicians often treat it, that this is about our society. This is about human community, and it's deteriorating in these circumstances. And the final point I would make is that what it tells us is that our economic system obeys a set of priorities that isn't based on human welfare and human well-being. And as a result, I think it has to force us to ask major questions about how our economic relationships, our economic structures should be organized.
When we think about how our economy is organized, we often leave it to the experts to tell us how we should create wealth in our society. Invariably, this has been presented to us in very deterministic terms. You know, we are told that the tar sands project, for instance, which is incredibly costly, there's the amount of subsidies that are poured into to create this oil that destroys the topsoil and displaces many indigenous people, has been justified and called ethical oil in comparison to other non-ethical countries who produce oil. How do we fight against this double speak that calls something ethical because it's less unethical than, you know, in other places, rapacious dictatorship, but at the same time ignores the erosion of ecosystems and of people, right, as you displace them? Can you speak to this and to the level of division that it creates among people, those who want to protect the resources, the water, the air, and those who feel that there is a need to create economic wealth?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think you've really put your finger on something with your starting with your opening comment, these leave it to the experts idea. One of the things that the dominant groups in our society do is they try to create the idea that economics is an extremely complicated matter, that the average citizen, the average person couldn't possibly understand it. It involves all kinds of obscure, difficult, and mysterious kinds of processes, and you need great mathematical intelligence to make any sense of it. Of course, these people who allegedly have all these great skills have now produced mass unemployment, a global recession, and so on. So they obviously haven't done a very good job of it, have they? But more than that, it's a way of mystifying our reality to disempower people, to make them feel powerless about some of the most important things that happen in their lives. Because, as I was saying earlier, economics isn't just about numbers. It's about housing. It's about health care. It's about mental health. It's about the sense of community. It's about environmental sustainability. It's about the rights of all people to share the planet so that we don't, as you were talking about, violate the rights of indigenous peoples and so on. And many of these so-called ethical corporations really engage in the most terrible hypocrisy, so that if you read their documents, they have ethical codes of conduct. And yet, if we had enough time, we could start to name Canadian mining corporations in countries like Honduras and Peru and Bolivia and Guatemala and so on, who have been found guilty of international human rights violations, of the violation of the rights of indigenous peoples, time after time after time. And yet they sit in their offices in Toronto or Calgary or Vancouver, and they pretend to wash their hands of the blood that is actually flowing because of the corporate plunder that they do. So I think it's very, very important that we call out their responsibility, that just because they have an ethical code of conduct that hangs on a wall in an office in Canada somewhere, we need to examine their practices on the ground. What do they actually do to their people they employ, to the communities where they dig their mines, extract minerals and resources, the indigenous peoples who they displace, and so on? And yes, we are seeing the same thing here with a project like the tar sands. And so all of that comes down to a question of saying, let us always ask, is this economic project advancing human well-being, not the bottom line for a corporation, but human well-being? And if it is not, then it is not ethical. The final point I would make, because it's very important what you also say, the kind of deterministic and fatalistic idea people have about the economy, is that people can force governments to change course. One of the things we're seeing in Europe, let's take Greece as an example right now, is that the Greek government keeps imposing austerity. That is to say, it privatizes more corporations. It lays off more public employees. It cuts education and healthcare budgets. It reduces pensions. And it's done this now 6 or 7 different times over the last 2 years in order to pay back the international financial institutions. But we need to ask ourselves, why should they even pay those debts? And interestingly, that's what the people of Argentina said in 2002. And they created such mass social pressure, the movements of the unemployed, the movements of people who were occupying factories that were shutting down, the mass movements of women and environmentalists and others. They simply said, repudiate the debts, do not pay them. And they forced their government to tell global financiers, we're not paying back. These debts were unethical. We do not accept them and we do not recognize them. And that broke this whole deterministic logic. It showed that democratic pressure and social mobilization, people could force a government not to obey the ruling dogma and the ruling doctrine that financial markets always have to be satisfied. And I think the example of Argentina in 2002 is very, very important for people around the world right now. We do have choices. We don't have to simply obey financial markets, because financial markets are run by enormous global banks and hedge funds worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. And if they made loans that went bad, that's their problem as private institutions. It's not our problem as people to bail them out.
But the other part of our so-called economic engine is how we use nature as a resource, as something mm-hmm. that is an object that can be manipulated, molded, and used to whatever needs, you know, we need to meet, right? And in this case, we're looking at the tar sand, which has been identified as one of the most disastrous projects against nature, and yet it is being justified as being an ethical project. I wonder if you could comment on the kinds of things that we could create with the subsidies that we allocate to this project, and the move to alternative forms of energy, to alternative ways of utilizing and creating life in a way that is not based on expansion of suburbs into nature and ecosystems, but perhaps in a way that is more integrated, where we can be interconnected and living in community with one another.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and again, taking off from your first point, what we're really talking about here is treating our relationship to the natural environment as a reciprocal one, to use a term that you talked about earlier, rather than an exploitative one. What our market economic system does is it looks at the entire natural world in terms of what can be turned into a commodity that can be sold for profit. And the consequences of commodifying, of turning things into commodities, the environmental consequences are irrelevant if it can be profitable. The corporation doesn't have to pay for greenhouse gases. The corporation doesn't have to pay for poisoning water systems, and so on. And as a result, it's that same economic logic of the manic pursuit of production for profit, which drives all of that. Because, of course, you're right, Sylvia, from the standpoint of environmental sustainability, the long-term health of the human species as part of the natural world, because we're not separate from it, we're one species among millions of others on this planet, sharing this ecosystem, it has not served the health of the human species or of the planet by this kind of exploitation of natural resources without any care for the larger ecological consequences. And there are very viable alternatives. Wind and solar power in particular have enormous untapped capacities. And interestingly, they could also address many of the other kinds of issues that we're dealing with right now. That is to say, about meaningful employment for people. One of the really interesting things, for instance, is that there are unions in Canada which have drawn up plans showing how manufacturing plants that are being shut down could very economically be converted to producing solar panels or diesel buses. Now, these are things which would dramatically reduce our consumption of fossil fuels and our production of greenhouse gases. Mass transit, public transit, does the same thing. In Toronto, we finally have a campaign which is arguing for free and accessible public transit and saying that if you took all the kinds of subsidies, which, as you mentioned, are going into projects like the tar sands, and redirected it towards low emissions, affordable mass transit, we would dramatically reduce the use of cars. We would dramatically improve the atmosphere that we breathe. We would enormously reduce greenhouse gases and so on. So there are very viable alternatives, but at this point, the big problem for private corporations is that they haven't been able to establish ownership of the sun. They haven't been able to establish ownership of the wind, because we're talking about using those enormous sources of energy on our planet and using them in environmentally responsible ways that really you can't make much of a profit from. Solar energy really requires public investment. The same is true of wind power. And so we're really challenging the whole idea of an economic market system that wants to turn everything into commodities for profit. So I think you're right to point out that environmental sustainability goes hand in hand with an economics that puts people first, not profit.
What kind of assistance do you envision to counteract the capitalist system, which, as we have seen, has been funded on constant crisis after crisis, and the constant, you know, bloodletting of the poor in order to, satiate the rapacious hunger of the wealthy?
I think we're in the early stages of a new global resistance movement. I think that the movement that we saw beginning in the 1990s that created the World Social Forums and developed that beautiful slogan, "Another World is Possible," laid the groundwork for this new phase of a global resistance movement. And, of course, it's no secret that much of that movement began in the Global South and particularly in Latin America. Whether we think about the Zapatista Rebellion in Chiapas, Mexico, whether we think about the great movements against privatization of water in Bolivia, whether we're thinking about the enormously inspiring movement of students in Chile who are protesting against private education and demanding that education be a right for all, free and accessible higher education. That movement, I believe, is now spreading in a much more global way. That inspiration which came from parts of the Global South, I think, is now really resonating in the Global North. And we could see that, I believe, for instance, when the big student movement, the youth movements, really, in Spain, started to occupy city centers. They just pitched tents, tens of thousands of them took over the city centers, and they said, "We demand a future." Well, in Spain right now, the official unemployment rate for youth is 45%. That's the official government statistic for youth unemployment. They are being sacrificed in the name of austerity, the young people of Spain and Ireland and Portugal and so on, Greece. We're now seeing it, of course, at the very heart of the system with the Occupy Wall Street, and has obviously inspired hundreds of thousands of people in other cities. And so I think what we're seeing is an emerging global resistance movement that is saying, as they did on Wall Street, we are the 99%. This economic system that exploits and impoverishes people works for 1%. They do fantastically well, that 1%. They live lives of luxury that we can't imagine. Now, I personally think they are psychologically and spiritually empty lives, but they are, as we talked about earlier, lives where they enjoy enormous wealth and power. But the majority are excluded from that and always will be in this system. So I think what we're seeing is the emergence of a global resistance movement which is probably more focused than ever before in world history on going into the heart of our cities and occupying public space so they cannot be ignored, sending out a message that they are standing up to the financial and economic corporate interests that are strangling our planet and humankind. And I think that's very hopeful and very inspiring. I don't want to pretend for a moment that those movements don't have a lot of very hard work ahead of them. They need to become broader, more inclusive. They have to be able to reach out beyond city centers. They have to find their roots among poor, working class, immigrant people in all kinds of communities and neighborhoods. But I think the message that they're sending really appeals to huge numbers. And I think we, as I say, that we're in the early stages of that kind of global resistance movement right now.
Thank you so much for being with us. And once again, give us your website so people can access your book. And
My website is davidmcnally.org, and you'll find some of my blogs and details about my book, Global Slump, there.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvie. It's always a pleasure.
Take care. That was Dr. David McNally. He's a professor in Toronto, and his latest book is Global Slump. If you'd like to learn more information, you can go to our website, latinwavesmedia.com. Listen to previous interviews. Listen to previous recorded music, artists. There's lots of stuff there you can visit. So latinwavesmedia.com.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.